promising to dispense more goodies than the other fellow. When judged even by short-term success, however, the New Deal must be considered a failure. Other nations saw industrial growth in the 1930s, including New Zealand, Japan, Greece, Romania, Chile, Denmark, Finland, and Sweden, but not the United States. Life expectancy, which had increased steadily for 16 years before Roosevelt, abruptly dropped by 1940, over a year before America went into World War II, and the gap in life expectancy between blacks and whites grew. The national debt had exploded, growing more in 8 years of Roosevelt's rule than in the previous 150 years of the nation's existence. Average unemployment in 1939, after 8 years of New Deal solutions, was higher than in 1931, before FDR gained the presidency. Birth rates fell, but homicides rose. From 1900 to 1960, the annual national murder rate surpassed 10,000 only 7 times, and all 7 years were on Roosevelt's watch. Divorce rates, suicide rates, syphilis cases, and arrests all increased during the New Deal years. Bums rode the railroads, and train jumpers died at the highest levels ever from 1933 to 1936. Of course, income tax rates soared, production shut down, and there was a capital strike as those few who had money hoarded it rather than let Roosevelt confiscate upward of 3/4 of their income. Worse, as Amity Schles notes, Roosevelt and his staff were becoming habitual bullies, pitting Americans against one another. Moreover, the New Deal caused a new influx of corporate money into politics unlike anything seen before. What stands out is how little business gave to either political party prior to the Great Depression and the manipulation of the tax code that politicians wrought in an attempt to combat corporate donations. Corporate donors learned in 1936 that government had put itself in the position of picking winners and losers in the tax code, and for the first time, they needed to influence politicians with money on a regular basis. The New Deal: immediate goals, unintended results. New Deal program, Civilian Conservation Corps. Intended effect and/or immediate result, to provide employment to 2.5 million, address conservation issues. Long-term effect after 50 years, negligible. Program ended in 1942. New Deal program, Agricultural Adjustment Act. Intended effect and/or immediate result, to control production, raise prices by offering subsidies to farmers. Farm income rose 51%, but did not return to 1929 levels until 1941. Long-term effect after 50 years, farm subsidies raised prices to consumers, benefited large agribusinesses, and encouraged overproduction. In 1995, Congress ended most agricultural subsidies because of cost, inefficiency, and discrimination against both consumers and small farmers. Subsidies on dairy products and sugar remained. New Deal Program, Glass-Steagall Act, 1935. Intended effect and/or immediate result, to separate investment banking, brokerage of stocks and bonds, from commercial banking, loans, checking, and savings accounts. Long-term effect after 50 years allowed financial institutions other than banks, for example insurance companies, to compete with banks in a wide range of services such as checking and insurance, limited American banks' ability to compete in world markets and to diversify. New Deal Program, Tennessee Valley Authority Act, intended effect and/or immediate result, to create the TVA and provide government-subsidized electric power to private citizens. Long-term effect after 50 years, developed Tennessee River Valley hydroelectric dams with locks, increased government's intrusion into private sector electricity utility operations, fostered monopolies in electric power. New Deal Program, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, 1934, intended effect and or immediate result to ensure all bank deposits up to $5,000 per account bring stability to the banking system. Long-term effect after 50 years. Sister agency, Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, FSLIC, contributed to the collapse of the S&L industry in the 1970s and 1980s by encouraging risky investments by managers and owners. Total TAB, $800 billion. New Deal Program, Revenue Act of 1935. Intended effect and or immediate result? To offset huge federal deficits under FDR by enacting huge tax hikes and estate taxes. Long-term effect after 50 years? Accelerated progressive notions of redistribution by targeting upper classes. Did not offset deficits, but rather ensured that the rich would continue to avoid taxes by being able to move money offshore or purchase tax-free municipal bonds, shifting the real burden onto the poor and middle classes. Concept remained in place until John Kennedy's and Ronald Reagan's cuts, both of which increased the amount paid by the wealthy. New Deal Program, Works Progress Administration, 1935. Intended effect and or immediate result? To create public works jobs for 9 million to construct bridges, sidewalks, art theaters, opera houses, and other projects. Long-term effect after 50 years? Ended in 1943 during World War II. By 1937, though, unemployment had again soared to 14 million. Many WPA projects were unnecessary economically and often catered to the elites, opera houses, art galleries, etc., and subsidized via deficits. New Deal Program, Social Security Act. Intended effect and/or immediate result. To provide a supplemental old age pension and emergency unemployment compensation, as well as aid to families with dependent children. AFDC. Long-term effect after 50 years. Because of cross-generational transfers, the Social Security Trust Fund, while solvent during the baby boom years, is projected to be in severe deficit by 2020, and depending on the economic conditions, bankrupt not long after that, even according to the most optimistic estimates. The system faces massive overhaul, with higher taxes, lower benefits, or privatization. One result of AFDC was the illegitimacy explosion of the 1960s to 1970s and was substantially curtailed in 1995 as part of the Welfare Reform Bill. New Deal Program, Fair Labor Standards Act, 1938. Intended effect and/or immediate result? To set minimum wages and maximum hours that could be worked. Raised wages in industry while reducing employment overall. Long-term effect after 50 years? New studies suggest this might have prolonged the Great Depression. Minimum wage laws in the 1950s and 1960s were closely correlated with minority teenage unemployment at the time, suggesting the laws encouraged discrimination. Social change in the Great Depression. With the end of Prohibition, the saloon business mushroomed, one of the few growing areas of enterprise in the 1930s. Another growing industry which served somewhat the same purpose with less destructive physical effects was motion pictures. Although several studios met with hard times during the Depression, movies became more popular than ever, providing a low-cost way for people to escape reality temporarily. Some 60 to 90 million Americans went to the movies every week, seeing classic stars such as Greta Garbo, Jean Harlow, Clark Gable, Cary Grant, and Joan Crawford, as well as a relatively new use of the silver screen for full-length animated features pioneered by Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, 1937. Walt Disney Studios, MGM, Warner Brothers, and many others cranked out Formula Pictures from the famous studio system in which a motion picture company signed artists and directors to long-term contracts, making them, in some cases, little more than assembly line employees. The assembly line process of making movies led to great names in the industry being shuffled in and out of pictures like the interchangeable bolts and screws in Eli Whitney's factory. For all its detractors, the studio system attained, at least briefly, a level of quality that has never been matched. Consider the stunning releases of 1939, by far the best year in motion picture history, with no others coming close. Several notable pictures received Academy Award nominations, including Dark Victory, Of Mice and Men, and Wuthering Heights. At least five of the nominees rank among the greatest films ever to grace the silver screen: The Wizard of Oz, Stagecoach, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and of course, the picture that swept the Academy Awards, Gone with the Wind. That year, John Wayne, Judy Garland, Jimmy Stewart, and Clark Gable all appeared in roles that defined their careers. Even B-list movies from that year, such as Beau Geste, are considered classics. Radio broadcasting also reached new heights, with more than 39 million households owning radios by the end of the 1930s. They heard stars like comedians Jack Benny and Edgar Bergen, or listened to adventure shows such as The Lone Ranger. Perhaps the event that best demonstrated radio's tremendous influence was Orson Welles' broadcast of The War of the Worlds on October 30, 1938, on the Mercury Theater on the Air. The broadcast induced mass panic, as Welles convinced thousands of Americans that Martians had landed and had laid waste to major cities in an interplanetary war. The popularity of radio and movies said much about the desire of Americans to escape from the circumstances of the Depression, and also from the relentless criticism of American life that emanated from intellectual circles. Such attacks on American institutions commonly appeared in many of the books deemed classics today, but which inspired few at the time. Chief among the critical writers of the day, John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, 1939, and Tortilla Flat, 1935, and John Dos Passos, Adventures of a Young Man, 1939, won literary acclaim, but the general public passed their books on the way to purchase Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, 1936. Americans showed that they needed chicken soup for the soul, stories of courage, hope, and optimism, not another application of leeches or a dose of castor oil masquerading as social commentary. The First Referendum. After 4 years of the New Deal, many of the programs seemingly had shown positive short-term results. Unemployment had dropped from 12 million to about 8 million, the banking system had been saved, and the panic mentally associated with the stock market crash had ebbed. Most important, Roosevelt's flurry of activity convinced average Americans that he cared about their circumstances and that the administration was at least trying to solve the nation's economic woes. On the other hand, most of the long-term dangers and structural damage done by New Deal programs remained hidden. Even business still hesitated to attack Roosevelt's statism, which provided a chance for those companies still operating to solidify their hold on the market free of new competitors. Thus, Roosevelt stood little chance of being unseated by any candidate in 1936. The Republicans ran Alf Landon, governor of Kansas, who all but endorsed Roosevelt with a Me Too Only Better attitude as a sacrificial candidate. Landon was trounced, receiving only the electoral votes of Maine and Vermont. The Democratic Party completed its remarkable comeback from the depths of Reconstruction by forging a new coalition. Despite the hardships caused by the New Deal's agricultural programs, farmers, especially in the South and West, still remained loyal to the party. Unionized labor's votes were cemented through the minimum wage legislation and the Wagner Act, whereas ethnic groups such as Italian Catholics and Jews were enticed by large numbers of political appointments and repelled by memories of the Republicans' prohibition policies. But the newest group to complete the coalition was comprised of blacks, who had supported the GOP since Reconstruction. The shift of the black vote provided the Democratic Party with its single most loyal constituency well after the millennium. Eleanor Roosevelt, in particular, publicly courted black voters for her husband, and public education programs temporarily provided a stimulus for reducing black illiteracy. New Deal public health programs also proved popular, and Roosevelt's rhetoric, if not his actions, was supportive and sympathetic to black concerns. Republicans, who had essentially abandoned blacks after 1877 and refused to challenge Plessy, lost their appeal to black citizens, who still labored under strict segregation in parts of the country and blatant racial discrimination virtually everywhere. A combination of blacks, unions, ethnic groups, and big city intellectual elites ensured Democratic dominance over both houses of Congress for more than 40 years, ensuring a total grip on public policy agendas, even when Republican presidents were in office. FDR also wielded massive patronage powers through the New Deal programs. In the 1934 midterm elections, Democrat advisors identified 60 key congressional districts where a sudden infusion of New Deal jobs could turn the tide in their favor. Federal money poured into 6 West Virginia districts, while Maine got over $100 million for public works jobs employing 44,000 people. Pennsylvania, which had received just under $13 million in 4 years of the Hoover administration, was swamped with over $678 million. Purely put, Roosevelt bought entire sections of the country with government programs. Roosevelt's second 100 days promised to exceed the ambitions of the first term, building on the huge congressional majorities and his re-election landslide. The president proposed a new set of radical taxes and redistributionist measures aimed at ending inheritance, penalizing successful corporations, and beginning a steady attack on top-bracket individual fortunes. It is worth reiterating, however, that New Deal policies were only aimed, in part, at restoring the American economy, just as Reconstruction policies were only directed, in part, at helping the freedmen. One important objective always lurked just below the smooth waters of Roosevelt's rhetoric, and that was the ability of his policies to maintain the Democratic Party in power for the next several generations. Virtually every one of the New Deal programs in some way made people more dependent on government, not more independent or self-sufficient. And when the government was run by Democrats, the logical conclusion voters had to draw was that whatever they got from government came from the Democrats. Social Security, farm subsidies, special favors for labor, they all targeted separate groups and played on their specific fears, and all problems were solved only through the efforts of Democratic politicians in Washington. Merely to raise the question of whether such policies were wise invited attack at election time, usually in the form of a question to the usually Republican opponent, why do you want to fill in the blank with take food away from the elderly, keep farmers poor, and so on? Roosevelt had created a sea change, therefore, not only in dealing with a national economic crisis, but also by establishing an entirely new political culture of democratic dominance for decades to come. The New Deal stalls. Just as it appeared that the New Deal might enter a higher orbit in the universe of policymaking, several events brought the Roosevelt administration down to earth. First, the Supreme Court, with a string of rulings, found that many components of the New Deal, including the NRA, the AAA, and a number of smaller New Deal acts, or state variants of New Deal laws, were unconstitutional. Seeing the Supreme Court as standing athwart the tide of progressive history, FDR found an obscure precedent in the British system that, he thought, allowed him to diminish the relative vote of the four hardcore conservatives on the Supreme Court by simply adding more members, the judicial equivalent of watering down soup. Roosevelt justified his bold attempt by arguing that the justices were overworked, proposing that for every justice of at least 10 years' experience over the age of 70, the president should be allowed to appoint a new one. Here, FDR not only alienated many of his congressional supporters, who were themselves in their 60s and 70s, but also positioned himself against the checks and balances system of the federal government. His actions impressed Italian fascist Benito Mussolini, who observed, "America has a dictator." In FDR, "There are no longer intermediaries between him and the nation," noted the Italian dictator. The issue threatened to erode much of Roosevelt's support in Congress until abruptly the Supreme Court issued several decisions favorable to the New Deal, and at the same time one of the conservative justices announced his retirement. A more pliable court in the eyes of the New Dealers killed the court reform bill before it caused FDR further damage. Over the next 3 years, Roosevelt appointed five of his own men, all Democrats, to the Supreme Court, making it a true Roosevelt court and further molding Washington into a one-party town. Roosevelt was preparing to launch another round of legislation when a second development hammered the administration on the economic front. In 1937, the nation had finally squeaked past the output levels attained before the crash, marking 7 years worth of complete stagnation. Then, suddenly, the business index plummeted, dropping below 1935 levels. Steel production dropped from 80% of capacity to below 20%, and government deficits shot up despite all-time high levels of taxation. Some in the Brain Trust rightly perceived that business had been terrorized, but the timing wasn't right. No particular act had just been implemented. What had so frightened industry? The answer was that the cumulative effects of the minimum wage law, the Wagner Act, high taxation, and Keynesian inflationist policies all combined with what now appeared to be unchecked power in FDR's hands. Hearing a new explosion of heated anti-monopolist rhetoric by Roosevelt's advisors, business began to question how long it could absorb further punishment. Although in the early 1930s, American business had supported some of the relief programs to keep from being the scapegoats of the Depression, by late in the decade, the business community feared that even the most radical social and political reorganization was not beyond consideration by the New Dealers. Assistant Attorney General Robert Jackson singled out by name leading industrialists and criticized their salaries. Harold Ickes charged that 60 families sought to establish control over the nation, and that the struggle must be fought through to a finish. Roosevelt's New Dealers had taken Reconstruction-era sectional antagonisms, repackaged them as class envy, and offered them up on an apocalyptic scale that was the Great Depression equivalent of waving the bloody shirt, or perhaps more fittingly, waving the unemployment compensation check. The New Dealers' comments made business more skittish than it already was and precipitated the Roosevelt recession. Between October 1937 and May 1938, WPA relief rolls in the auto towns in the Midwest swelled, increasing 194% in Toledo and 434% in Detroit. St. Louis, Cleveland, Omaha, and Chicago all eliminated or drastically curtailed welfare and unemployment payments. Nationally, unemployment rose from near 12% back to 19%. The ranks of organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers, which opposed the New Deal, started to swell. Roosevelt nevertheless remarked, "We are on our way back. We planned it that way." What FDR did not understand was that although many people accepted some New Deal programs as necessary, they saw them as only temporary expedients. Meanwhile, the New Dealers were never able to develop an adequate reform ideology to challenge the business rhetoricians. A third shift against the New Deal came at the ballot box. The public grew concerned enough about the unchecked power of the Democrats that in the 1938 midterm elections, the Republicans picked up 81 seats in the House, 8 in the Senate, and 13 governorships. It was a stinging rebuke to New Deal excesses and was achieved despite the fact that the Democrats had started to call in their patronage markers. This meshing of politics and jobs during the 1938 congressional elections raised another unsettling aspect of the New Deal. Allegations that WPA funds had been used in a Kentucky campaign prompted a Senate investigation which raised questions about the potential abuse of federal offices for electioneering. As a consequence, the Hatch Act, prohibiting political activity by federal officials or campaign activities on federal property, and named for Senator Carl Hatch of New Mexico, was passed in 1939. Fourth, Roosevelt had caused more than a little concern when he introduced a benign-appearing reorganization bill in Congress. At first, it appeared to be a routine reshuffling of bureaucratic agencies. But by the time Congress, which was now more Republican, debated the bill in 1938, the court packing scheme was fresh in the legislators' minds, as was the fascist takeover of the Weimar Republic in Germany. No one thought FDR was Hitler, but papers were increasingly using the term dictator when they referred to the president. Congress decided that Roosevelt had started to infringe on constitutional separation of powers. Shocking the president, 108 Democrats crossed the aisle to defeat the reorganization bill in the House, prodded by thousands of telegrams from home. Reaction to Roosevelt's power grab revealed how deeply entrenched values regarding private property, opportunity, and upward mobility still were. Despite 6 years of controlling the American economy, of dominating the political appointment process, of rigging the system with government bribes to special interest groups, and of generally favorable press, the public still resisted attempts to socialize the industrial system or hand the president more power. It was a healthy sign, one not seen across the oceans, where dark forces snuffed out the light of freedom. Demons Unleashed. As the nation struggled in its economic morass, events in Europe and Asia had posed an additional and even more serious threat than the Depression. For more than a decade, Americans had enjoyed relative peace in foreign affairs and had taken the lead in forging so-called arms control agreements. This was not out of altruism or pacifism, but out of a practical awareness that in the Atlantic, the United States could keep up with Great Britain, but only at the expense of ceding the Pacific to the rising empire of Japan. America's relationship with Japan had been deteriorating for years. In 1915, Japan had stated in its 21 demands that it had a special position in China. 2 years later, with the United States at war in Europe, Japanese negotiators upped the ante in their bid for dominance of China when Viscount Kikujiro Ishii met with Robert Lansing, the Secretary of State. In the resulting Lansing-Ishii agreement, the United States acknowledged that Japan had special interests in China, essentially abandoning the open door won just 20 years earlier, whereby Americans could trade freely in China. Reining in the Japanese in China had to involve obtaining naval parity in the Pacific. That proved to be no small task. The Empire of Japan had emerged victorious in two major naval actions in the Russo-Japanese War, although the Japanese also captured Port Arthur on the Russian Pacific coast. The victory had come at a terrible cost, revealing that Japan would face severe difficulties if it ever engaged in a full-scale land war with Russia. Although Japan had courted both British and American favor during the first decade of the 1900s, by the 1930s, stung by what it viewed as discriminatory treatment in the Washington Conference agreements, Japan increasingly looked to herself. America had competitors, and perhaps enemies, on each ocean, and the most practical method of leveling the playing field was to restrain naval construction. That was the thought behind the Washington Conference. Ever since Lansing Ishii, Japanese strategy had emphasized large-scale naval battles that sought to bring the enemy into one climactic engagement. But Japanese planners recognized that it would be years before they could produce a fleet comparable to that of either the British or the Americans, and so although they chafed at the inequitable provisions of the Washington Conference, arms limitations temporarily provided a means to tie up potential adversaries in meaningless agreements while quietly catching up technologically where it really mattered. All signatories to the Washington Pact accepted as fact the continued dominance of the battleship in future naval actions. In doing so, they all but ignored a series of critical tests in 1921 when an Army Air Force colonel, William "Billy" Mitchell, staged a demonstration that flabbergasted Army and Navy brass. Using the Ostfriedland, a German battleship acquired by the U.S. Navy in the Treaty of Versailles, as a target, Mitchell managed to sink the ship with bomber aircraft while the vessel was in the open sea. Although Mitchell violated many rules of the test, including using larger bombs than were permitted, the damage done sank the ship, which many, if not most, of the battleship admirals considered an impossibility. After the fact, the astonished naval officers still refused to believe that it was anything other than a trick. 4 years later, in 1925, Navy aircraft attacked a U.S. fleet in simulated bombing runs and destroyed some 60 ships, all without the anti-aircraft guns scoring a single hit on the towed targets. This pathetic performance occurred despite the fact that naval gunners fired off 880 rounds against the attackers. Mitchell was later court-martialed for his comments on an unrelated issue when he criticized the government for failing to provide weather stations after the lightning-induced destruction of the blimp Shenandoah. During his court-martial proceedings, Mitchell outlined how an Asian enemy, he said, the Empire of Japan, could launch a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor and expect complete success. Japan took notes on Mitchell's concepts, and the attack on Pearl Harbor bore an eerie resemblance to his scenario. By the time of his death in 1936, few besides Mitchell considered Japan any kind of serious threat. And no one thought much could come from a revived Italy led by Benito Mussolini and his fascist party. Mussolini was the son of a blacksmith and, in all respects, a problem child who was expelled from school. A socialist party member, Mussolini had taught school, served at the front in World War I, where he was wounded, and became a newspaper editor. Along with Antonio Gramsci, Mussolini formed a new political movement, a hybrid of state corporatism, nationalism, and socialism called fascism. The fascists' economic doctrines lacked any cohesion except that they wedged a layer of corporate leaders between state planning and the rest of the economy. There was no operation of the free market in fascism and little freedom overall. As Mussolini put it, everything in the state, nothing outside the state. Fascism presented the illusion of a group of independent corporate leaders who, in reality, acted as extensions of the state and were allowed to keep impressive salaries as a payoff. Even there, however, the Italian state bought large stockholdings in the major banks and other companies, making it the leading stockholder in ventures controlling 70% of iron production and almost half of all steel production. It was as close to communism as one could get without collectivizing all industry, and fascism certainly shared with communism a bent for terrorism and violence. Progressive Lincoln Steffens admitted that fascism and communism were blood brothers by referring to the Russian-Italian method of governing. There was no life without shedding blood, according to Mussolini. Praise for the New Deal came from fascist foreign leaders. Mussolini wrote that Roosevelt's program reminded him of his own, reminiscent of the ways and means by which fascism awakened the Italian people. The mood accompanying Roosevelt's program, he insisted, resembles that of fascism. Mussolini's staff expressed concerns to Il Duce that his laudatory reviews of the American president were actually hurting him with his electorate, and issued an order curtailing such comments. The official newspaper of the German Nazi Party in 1934 also issued glowing praises of FDR and the New Deal. That did not prevent Roosevelt's advisor Rexford Tugwell from admitting, "I find Italy doing many of the things which seem to me necessary," and admired the fact that Mussolini has the press controlled so that they cannot scream lies at him daily. Roosevelt's own research and planning division of the NRA produced a study called Capitalism and Labor Under Fascism and concluded that the fascist principles in Germany and Italy are very similar to those which have been evolving in America, emphasis ours. The fact that so many American liberals would find a kinship with fascism and that their pseudo-romantic overtures would be reciprocated by Nazi Germany and fascist Italy serves to expose the lie that fascism was right-wing or conservative. Instead, it was progressive in its direction and overall goals. In fact, Mussolini himself had not broken with the socialists over economic issues, but over Italy's participation in World War I, and he seized as the symbol of his fascist party the Roman fasces, a bundle of sticks tied around an axe representing authority and strength. From its origin, fascism was never anything but convoluted socialism, a point obscured still further by Adolf Hitler in Germany with his incessant attacks on both capitalism and communism. Seeing Jews behind each allowed him to conceal fascism's close similarity to Stalin's Soviet system. In 1922, Mussolini's followers staged a march on Rome, handing him the Italian government, after which the Italian king named Il Duce, the leader, prime minister of Italy. Mussolini thus took by intimidation what he could not win at the ballot box. Within 2 years after censoring press opposition, but not completely closing down antagonistic publishers and manipulating the voting laws, he consolidated all power into his party's hands, with himself as dictator, albeit one far weaker than the Nazi leader. Fables that he made the trains run on time and worked other economic miracles were more publicity and propaganda than fact, but they attracted the attention of many Americans, especially before the German Nazis started to enact their anti-Jewish legislation. Among those who lauded Mussolini was Breckinridge Long, ambassador to Italy, who called fascism the most interesting experiment in government to come above the horizon since the formulation of our Constitution. Long praised the fascisti in their black shirts. They are dapper and well-dressed, and stand up straight and lend an atmosphere of individuality and importance to their surroundings. A young American diplomat named George Kennan, far from being repulsed by the fascists, concluded that benevolent despotism had greater possibilities for good than did democracy, and that the United States needed to travel along the road which leads through constitutional change to the authoritarian state. Meanwhile, Mussolini grew in popularity by promising the Italian people that he would restore the Roman Empire. With most of the former Roman Empire occupied by the French, Spaniards, Austrians, and others, Mussolini picked out the path of least resistance, parts of Africa not occupied by Europe, like Ethiopia. In 1935, Italian armies armed with the latest weapons, including aircraft, trucks, tanks, and machine guns, invaded a backward Ethiopia whose emperor begged the League of Nations to intervene. Except for minor sanctions, the League turned a deaf ear, and Italian forces captured the Ethiopian capital in 1936. Breckinridge Long, Il Duce's cheerleader in the administration, referred to Italy's crushing of backward Ethiopia as the fruitful harvest of Mussolini's enterprise. Like Mussolini, Adolf Hitler had had a troubled childhood. The son of a customs inspector, Hitler had dropped out of high school and worked as an artist in Vienna prior to World War I. He proved a failure at art, was twice rejected for architectural school, then finally enlisted in the German army at the start of the Great War. After the war, he joined the German Workers' Party, a socialist but anti-Marxist organization that emphasized nationalism and anti-Semitism. There, Hitler found his niche, developing the skills of a hypnotic speaker and emotional actor for the party, which had taken a new name, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or Nazis. Hitler toiled within the Nazi Party until the German hyperinflation of 1923 nearly caused the collapse of the Weimar Republic. Seeing his opportunity, Hitler led an attempted takeover, or putsch, but the police were ready for him. Arrested and sentenced to 5 years in prison, he wrote Mein Kampf, My Struggle, from behind bars. A rambling book that detailed his hatred for Jews, his intentions to create a new German Reich or empire, and his economic policies, which were as contradictory and confused as Mussolini's, Mein Kampf provided a roadmap for anyone willing to take it seriously. For example, he alerted everyone to his intentions of subjecting even the innocent to violence by stating that early in his political career, the importance of physical terror became clear to me. Hitler gained his release after only a few months in confinement, by which time the Nazis had emerged as a powerful force in German politics. He gained control of the party within 2 years. When Germany started to slide into the economic depression that gripped the rest of the world, Hitler had the issue he needed to appeal to large numbers of Germans, who responded to his call for a socialist reordering of society along the lines of Mussolini's corporatism. The Rome-Berlin Axis used a revolution in Spain as a warm-up to test its weapons and armies in combat. Playing on Japan's fears of an expansionist Soviet Union in the Far East, Hitler pulled Japan into the Axis as a de facto member with the Anti-Comintern Pact, 1935. Japan thus threw her lot in with an ideological cause for which the Japanese people had no connection or affinity except for apprehension about Soviet Russia. Still, the Japanese warlords resembled the fascists in their utter brutality, and the European fascist states and Japan did have one important trait in common, a growing comfort level with totalitarianism. The United States certainly wanted nothing to do with Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, a desert war over the questionable independence of some obscure African nation. Nor were the sides clear in Spain. How to choose, for example, between Hitler, who had yet to engage in mass murder, and Stalin, where reports of millions of deaths at his hands had already leaked out. Still, hundreds of idealistic Americans volunteered to fight in Spain against Franco, who had fascist ties but was no ally of Hitler's. Official non-involvement by the United States and Britain, however, set a pattern. The democracies would not intervene no matter who the villains were or how egregious their atrocities. The plea by Ethiopia to the League of Nations for help against Mussolini resembled an appeal 2 years earlier from halfway across the globe, from China, where American interests stood out more clearly. There, the Empire of Japan had expanded its foothold in Manchuria, gained in the Russo-Japanese War 1904-5. Although Manchuria, in theory, was independent, Japan occupied it as a protectorate. Then in September 1931, it ostensibly staged an attack on a Japanese railroad at Mukden as an excuse to send in the army. Within a few months, Japan had complete control over Manchuria, renaming it Manchukuo, which provided a jumping-off point for invading other areas of China, whose pleas for assistance the League ignored. Japan's actions came as its military was increasingly usurping civilian control of the government. Assassination of public officials began to match the levels associated with modern-day Colombia, but instead of criminal or drug gangs doing the killing, they were fanatical Japanese nationalists. In 1933, the emperor himself was nearly assassinated, a remarkable event, considering that the Japanese people view him as a god incarnate. Chicago-style gangsters often controlled the streets, replete with zoot suit garb and Thompson-style submachine guns. The more dangerous gangsters, however, roamed the palace halls and the military barracks. After a temporary recovery of parliamentary government in 1936, the military staged a coup attempt during which assassination squads and regular infantry units surrounded the imperial palace and attempted to assassinate the civilian leadership of Japan. They killed the finance and education ministers, injured the chamberlain, Admiral Kantaro Suzuki, and killed several other administrators. They failed to kill the prime minister, whose wife locked him in a cupboard, but assassins shot his brother by mistake. Another prime target, the emperor, also survived, and within days order had been restored. But no civilian leaders forgot, nor did the military, which was now calling the shots. Indeed, many of Japan's saviors merely looked for their own opportunity to grab power, which they saw increasingly as coming from expansion in China. It is significant that Japan, at a crossroads between expansion in China and Russia, her traditional rival to the north, chose China, which engaged Japanese forces in a quagmire. By 1937, Japanese troops had ruthlessly destroyed Shanghai and Canton and slaughtered 300,000 civilians in Nanking. At one point in the Rape of Nanking, as it was called in part because of the systematic atrocities against women, the Japanese marched some 20,000 young Chinese outside the city and machine-gunned them. In retrospect, the League's refusal to intervene in China and Ethiopia proved to be a costly error. American policy was pro-China in sentiment thanks to a large China lobby in Washington, but in action, America remained steadfastly aloof from the atrocities. Even after reports that the Chinese were hunted like rabbits in Nanking and that anything that moved was shot, and despite the fact that, in addition to Jiang's pro-Western army, Mao Zedong had a large communist army dedicated to evicting the Japanese, the United States government did not offer even token help, although some aid came through volunteers such as the famous Flying Tigers, American pilots who flew P-40 Warhawks with the famous shark's teeth painted on their noses. At one point in 1937, it appeared that the Japanese had become too brazen and careless. On December 12th, Imperial Japanese warplanes strafed and bombed several ships on the Yangtze River. Three of them were Standard Oil tankers, and the fourth, a U.S. gunboat, the Panay, was sunk despite flying a large American flag and having Old Glory spread out on the awnings. Two crewmen and an Italian journalist were killed, and another 11 were wounded. Even with a deliberate attack in broad daylight, however, popular sentiment resisted any thought of war. Roosevelt only asked his aides to examine whether the Japanese could be held liable for monetary damages. Several admirals argued that Japan intended a war with the United States, but they were ignored by all except Harold Ickes, who noted, "Certainly war with Japan is inevitable sooner or later, and if we have to fight her, isn't this the best possible time?" Upon reflection, the Japanese knew they had made a potentially disastrous miscalculation, one that could push them into a war with America years before they were ready. Consequently, Tokyo issued a thorough apology, promising to pay every cent in indemnities and recalling the commander of the Japanese naval forces. The measures satisfied most Americans, with newspapers such as the Christian Science Monitor urging its readers to differentiate between the Panay incident and the sinking of the Maine. Japan further saw that Britain would be tied up with Hitler should he press matters in Europe, opening up Malaya and, farther to the southeast, Indonesia and the rich Dutch oil fields. If the cards fell right, many strategists suggested, the Japanese might not have to deal with Great Britain at all. In this context, America's response would prove critical. The U.S. presence in the Philippines, Wake Island, Guam, and Hawaii meant that eventually Japan would have to negotiate or fight to expand her empire to the south and west. Instead, the United States compounded the disarmament mistakes of the 1920s by slumping into an isolationist funk. Isolationism ascendant. The very fact that the British hid behind their navy and the French behind their massive fortifications along the German border, the Maginot Line, indicated that the major Western powers never believed their own arms control promises. As in the United States, a malaise developed in these nations out of the Great Depression, producing a helplessness and lethargy. In many circles, a perception existed that nothing could be done to stop the Italian, German, and Japanese expansionists, at least within Europe and Asia. Moreover, the U.S. Senate's Nye Committee had investigated the munitions industry, the merchants of death that supposedly had driven the nation into World War I, adding to suspicions of those calling for military readiness. Britain remained the most important trading partner for American firms in the 1930s, but overseas trade was relatively insignificant to the domestic U.S. market, and the loss of that trade, while undesirable, was not crucial, except to the British, who desperately needed war goods. High tariffs remained the rule of the day, reflecting the prevailing doctrine that one nation could tax the work of another to its own benefit. That view changed sharply after Cordell Hull became Secretary of State under Roosevelt. A free trader who favored lower tariffs, his views would have been entirely appropriate for the 1920s and might have provided a firewall against the economic collapse. But by the mid-1930s, with the dictators firmly entrenched, the circumstances had changed dramatically enough to work against the doctrine of free trade. Indeed, at that point, the trade weapon had to be used, and events demanded that free nations play favorites in resisting aggressors. As the economic expansion of the 1920s gave way to the Great Depression, even stronger impulses toward isolation arose, as symbolized by the first Neutrality Act, 1935, issued in response to Ethiopia's plea for help. Further congressional action in early 1937 prohibited supplying arms to either side of the Spanish Civil War. Isolationists of every political stripe tended to portray all sides in a conflict as belligerents, thus removing any moral judgments about who might be the aggressor. The ambassador to Great Britain, Joseph Kennedy, went so far as to suggest that the democracies and the Axis powers put aside their minor disagreements and, in so many words, just get along. Cordell Hull was among the few who saw the unprecedented evil inherent in the Nazi regime. In the wake of the disastrous Munich Agreement of 1938, which ceded to Hitler the Sudetenland, he got all of Czechoslovakia in 1939, a move that Hull said would bring war. Speaking off the record to members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Hull bluntly warned them that the coming war would not be another goddamn piddling dispute over a boundary line, but a full-scale assault on the world order by powerful nations armed to the teeth, preaching a doctrine of naked force and practicing a philosophy of barbarism. Hull favored a cash-and-carry policy, which he thought would allow Britain to purchase whatever war materials were needed. In reality, however, at the time that the British desperately needed arms, food, and machinery, her accounts had sunk so low that she scarcely had the hard currency needed to actually purchase the goods. Hull's policy seemed a magnanimous gesture, but by then, much more generous terms were needed. Indeed, the Neutrality Acts often punished the states, Ethiopia or China, that had attempted to resist the Italian and Japanese aggressors. Such was the case with the 1937 cash-and-carry legislation, which sold American goods to any belligerent that could pay cash and ship the materials in its own vessels. Clearly, Britain, with her navy, benefited from this legislation the most. But Italy, Japan, and Germany fared well, too. The isolationist mood was encouraged by the intelligentsia, which, although supporting the pro-communist Republican forces in the Spanish Civil War, otherwise viewed any overseas escapades as inherently imperialistic. American leftists Walter Duranty, Upton Sinclair, Langston Hughes, E.W. Scripps, Alger Hiss, and Edmund Wilson had made excuses for Lenin's Red Terror and Stalin's Harvest of Sorrow, despite full knowledge that millions of Soviet citizens were being exterminated, and refused to engage in any public policy debates over the morality of one side or another. International communist movements also condemned any involvement against the Axis powers as imperialistic, at least until the Soviet Union herself became a target of Hitler's invasion in June 1941. For example, in 1940, communist-dominated delegations to the Emergency Peace Mobilization, which met in Chicago, refused to criticize the Axis powers, but managed to scorn the war policies of Roosevelt. Only after Operation Barbarossa and the Nazi advance into Russia did the peace groups change their tune. Against all these forces, solid leadership from Roosevelt's advisors, especially in the diplomatic corps, still might have convinced him and Congress that the fascists and the Japanese imperialists only understood power. Ickes, for example, lobbied for more severe sanctions against the Japanese. Other appointments proved colossally inappropriate, particularly the ambassadors to Britain and the Soviet Union. Joseph P. Kennedy, for example, the thief that FDR had chosen as head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, to catch a thief, received an appointment as ambassador to Britain, despite his outspoken anti-British views. Kennedy suspected every British move, convinced that England was manipulating Germany into another war. Joseph Davies, Roosevelt's ambassador to Russia, on the other hand, completely refused to criticize one of the most vile regimes on the planet. He said Joseph Stalin, despite exterminating all opponents within the Communist Party, is the easy boss type, quiet, self-effacing, personally kindly. Like all the other Soviet leaders, Stalin works hard, lives simply, and administers his job with complete honesty. The ambassador's naive characterizations extended to Stalin's subordinates, who, like Stalin, worked hard and lived simply, performing their tasks without corruption. It is generally admitted that no graft exists in high places in Moscow, he claimed. Even where Roosevelt appointed capable men, they were ill-suited for the time. Secretary of State Hull, a former judge and congressman from Tennessee, often seemed as anti-British as Kennedy, exactly at the time that the situation required the Western powers to resist aggression together. Instead of squarely facing the Axis threat in Europe, Hull sought to erode British trading influence in the Pacific to open more markets for U.S. goods. To his credit, Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau battled to sell both France and Britain top-of-the-line aircraft, to which Roosevelt finally agreed in late 1938, although it is uncertain whether Morgenthau favored the sales because they genuinely helped the Allies, or because, as he put it, our aircraft industry desperately needed a shot in the arm, and here was the hypodermic poised. Between 1937 and 1940, then, Roosevelt, prompted by Hull and Kennedy, provided only a modicum of support to Britain under exorbitant terms compared to the boatloads of materials later handed out to the Soviets at much lower costs. Yet even that small level of support enabled Britain to hold out during 1940 to 41. Desperate to avoid even the appearance of forming an alliance against the fascist powers, American diplomats blamed Britain and France for refusing to stand up to Hitler, and therefore, in essence, for saving Americans from having to confront the evil empires as well. Kennedy argued for giving Hitler a free hand in Eastern Europe. Ambassador to France, William Bullitt, urged a Franco-German accommodation, and Breckinridge Long, the former American ambassador to Italy, blamed Britain for treating Mussolini unfairly. Roosevelt looked for any assurance from Hitler that he would behave, in 1939 sending a message asking Hitler and Mussolini if they would promise not to attack some 31 nations named in the letter. Hitler responded by reading it to the Reichstag, mockingly ticking off Finland, Lithuania, Juden, to howls of laughter from the delegates, few of whom would have guessed that in the next few years he would seek to control or capture parts or all of these nations and peoples. In September 1939, Hitler's armies rolled into one of the nations he claimed to have no interest in invading, Poland. World War II had begun in Europe. America remained steadfastly neutral as the Blitzkrieg, or Lightning War, swept through the Polish armies, then turned on Denmark, Norway, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and France, all in less than a year. Even as Nazi tanks smashed French forces and trapped nearly 500,000 British and French troops at Dunkirk, Cordell Hull characterized French cries for U.S. support as hysterical appeals, and Joseph Kennedy bluntly told the British that they could expect zero support. Hull and Kennedy had their own agendas, but they probably reflected the fact that many, if not most, Americans wanted nothing to do with war. Just 2 years after Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, had returned from Munich with an agreement with Hitler that, he said, ensured peace in our time, All of mainland Europe was under the iron grip of the Nazis, Italian fascists, their allies, or the communist Soviets, whose behavior in taking half of Poland, as well as Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and part of Finland, somehow escaped the ire of the West. Britain stood alone. As British national reserves dwindled to $12 million, Britain, having depleted its dollar reserves, could no longer buy war materials or food. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who knew that America could not allow England to fall, wrote to FDR in a May 15, 1940 letter, "We shall go on paying dollars for as long as we can. But I should like to feel reasonably sure that when we can pay no more, you will give us the stuff all the same." Churchill begged Roosevelt to lend 50 aged World War I destroyers for anti-submarine patrols, and FDR finally came around. "I have been thinking very hard what we should do for England. The thing to do is to get away from a dollar sign." The answer was an exchange of weapons for long-term leases for several British bases, mostly in the Caribbean, although Roosevelt turned down a suggestion that would have included British ships in the West Indies, noting that they would be antiquated. He also rejected as too big a burden both on himself and the nation the suggestion that the United States take the West Indies themselves. The final legislation, which passed in March 1941, was known as the Lend-Lease Act. It assisted the British in protecting their sea lanes. Isolationists, more accurately non-interventionists, claimed Lend-Lease would drag the United States into the war. Senator Burton K. Wheeler called it the New Deal's AAA foreign policy. It will plow under every fourth American boy. Significantly, Roosevelt had rejected appeals from Norway and France, citing the fact that leasing ships to belligerents would violate international law. The destroyer deal reflected less a commitment to principle than an admission that the public mood was beginning to shift, and again demonstrated that far from leading from principle, FDR waited for the political winds to swing in his direction. Those winds had a considerably stealthy boost from British agents in the United States. Believing the Nazis a menace to their very existence, the British hardly played by the rules in attempting to lure America into the conflict as an ally. The British used deception and craftily tailored propaganda to swing American public opinion into bringing the United States into the war, engaging in covert manipulation of democratic processes to achieve their ends. Backed by a number of American pan-Atlanticists in newspapers, Congress, and even polling organizations, British agents conducted a silent war to persuade U.S. lawmakers to enact a peacetime draft, support Lend-Lease, and, they hoped, eventually ally the United States against Hitler. The most shocking and effective aspect of British covert operations in America involved shaping public opinion through polls. It is important to note that polls, which were supposedly designed to reflect the public's mood, in fact were used as tools to create a mandate for positions the pollsters wanted. Although this was the first documented time that polls would be used in such a way, it certainly wouldn't be the last. British agents working for Gallup and Roper, as well as other American polling organizations, alternatively suppressed or publicized polls that supported America's entry into the war. One American pollster, sympathetic to the British, admitted cooking polls by suggesting issues and questions, the vote on which I was fairly sure would be on the right side. In November 1941, the Fight for Freedom Committee, an interventionist group, ran a rigged poll at the Congress of Industrial Organizations National Convention, taking great care beforehand to make certain the poll results would turn out as desired. Another poll found 81% of young men facing the draft favored compulsory military service, an astoundingly high figure given that congressional mail ran overwhelmingly against conscription. On the other side of the argument were a few outright loonies, of course, including discredited socialists and the entire front for the American Communist Party. The American Peace Mobilization Committee, for example, had peace marches right up to the day that Hitler invaded the USSR, when signs protesting American involvement in the war were literally changed on the spot to read, "Open the Second Front." Where 5 minutes earlier American communists had opposed American involvement, once Stalin's bacon was in the fire, they demanded U.S. intervention. Besides these fringe groups, however, were millions of well-intentioned Americans who sincerely wanted to avoid another European entanglement. Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg, Republican of Michigan, aptly expressed the views of the vast majority of so-called isolationists when he wrote in his diary, "I hate Hitlerism and Nazism and communism as completely as any person living. But I decline to embrace the opportunist idea that we can stop these things in Europe without entering the conflict with everything at our command. There is no middle ground. We are either all the way in or all the way out." Indeed, the dirty little secret of the pre-war period was that polls, when not doctored by the British, showed that most Americans agreed with aviator Charles Lindbergh's anti-war position. A few months later, in February 1941, the Lone Eagle testified before Congress about his first-hand inspection of Hitler's Luftwaffe. Roosevelt, convinced the aviator was attempting to undermine his lend-lease program, launched a campaign through subordinates to convince Americans that Lindbergh was a Nazi. The entire saga showed how far the corruption of Hitler, Italian fascism, Japanese militarism, and Soviet communism had spread. The British conducted widespread spying and manipulations inside the borders of their closest ally. An American hero was tarred with the appellation Copperhead, a reference to Northern Confederate sympathizers during the Civil War, for holding a position different from the president's about the best way to defeat the Nazis, and the Roosevelt administration increasingly had to accommodate an utterly evil Stalinist regime in Russia for the sole reason that the Soviets were fighting the Nazis. Lindbergh, once the war started, flew 50 combat missions against Japan, only adding to his pre-war heroic image. Roosevelt then governed a nation that wanted to remain out of the conflict, yet despised the Axis and possessed deep sympathies for the English. Public attitudes required a clear presentation of both the costs of involvement and the dangers of neutrality. But FDR's foreign policy appointees lacked the skill to deal with either the British or the Axis. In that context, by 1940, the isolationists certainly had drifted into a never-never land of illusion, thereby risking essential strategic advantages that, if conceded, could indeed have threatened the U.S. mainland.